My guest is Patrick Wintour. Patrick Wintour is the diplomatic editor of The Guardian. Welcome to the podcast, Patrick.
Thank you so much. Thank you for asking me.
Right, we're going to talk about world events, surprise, surprise, but world events are moving so rapidly. I think for the first time in the 10 years I've been doing these podcasts, I'm going to specify at the very outset when we are recording this podcast, the morning of Wednesday, the 9th of April. So all our listeners know exactly when you were opining on the future of the world.
It will also prove how wrong I was in my opinions, because within 24 hours, they will have been proved incorrect. But anyway.
Well, we'll see. We'll see. Absolutely. Well, it's vaguely connected to that. I mean, how much of what's going on in the Trump administration and Trump's actions and rhetoric himself are a surprise to you? People say he was in the campaign trail. He was saying a lot of these things, certainly in Trump one, he was doing some of these things. And, you know, he goes, you can find on YouTube 35, 40-year-old clips of political talk shows where he's in broad term talking about these kind of things. How surprised have you been in the past 100 days or so?
Well, I've not been surprised by the last 100 days and the extent to which he's pursued change at the pace at which he has. I was surprised by the kind of sovereigntist sort of desire to take over Greenland, etc. And I guess the surprise about the trade war is that it wasn't more focused and that it really didn't seem to be the product of a long-term kind of policy discussion inside the administration. It seemed to be a lot of the decisions were being made at the last minute, and the way in which the tariffs were calculated seemed to be drawn down from the internet by some relatively young people. And obviously, one aspect of that is it's left exposed the divisions inside the Trump administration about whether this is the right thing to do. And I think what's really upset some people inside the administration is the degree to which this is a blanket tariff war rather than a focused tariff war with China. I mean, it may evolve and it has the potential to evolve into being a more focused tariff war with China. But the way in which it was launched was basically all allies were going to be attacked as much as opponents. And I think that's really probably been a huge political error. It also makes the scale of what's going on so much more vast.
Well, whether it's the tariffs or shredding up, you know, 80-year-old alliances since the end of the Second World War and all the rest of it, never mind all the domestic turmoil in the United States, how lasting is the damage likely to be? You know, the subtext of that question is, can a resistance be marshalled in terms of the midterm elections at the end of next year? He's only going to be around for another 3.5 years or so, and then he might be replaced. But more seriously, how lasting will the damage be, do you think?
Well, surely the long-term lasting damage is that no one can ever be sure that someone similar to Trump will not be elected again, and that therefore America is no longer the kind of reliable ally. And I guess when you saw some of the remarks by Mark Carney and also Keir Starmer about globalization being dead, I think what they were trying to convey is that America is, which was the inventor of globalization and its key proponent, has now abandoned it. And there is no likelihood that even if a Democratic administration was elected, that they'll return to kind of free trade in the old sense. So I think something permanent has changed, and the scale and the speed with which Trump is operating, his refusal to listen to others, including to people in Europe, means that there is a kind of fundamental rethinking about the relationship with America, and obviously plays into what someone like the French President Emmanuel Macron has been arguing for, you know, ever since that speech in the Sorbonne about the need for Europe to stand on its own 2 feet. And he may not politically be winning inside France, but I think intellectually he's winning inside the European Union.
So what do we now, as we speak, Patrick, make of the West, quote unquote? The West is still there. What does it comprise? What will it be its new priorities going forward? Can it function effectively without the United States?
Well, that is the argument and discussion that's still going on. And I guess here in the UK, Keir Starmer is the lead proponent of the argument that we can't abandon America. It's too central to both security and to economy, and that if there is to be a transition, it has to be a kind of phased transition, and one in which it can't be done overnight in the way in which Trump's trying to do it about the economy. And I think, I've been really impressed by the way Starmer has led on the issue of Ukraine and tried to keep America connected to European security. So the proposals he made about that there could be a force, what they call a reassurance force inside Ukraine, was important. But what was even more important was his clear statement that this needed American backing, and that the security of that force inside Ukraine was totally dependent on American support. So in that process, he was trying to keep America engaged with European security. And he is, I think, working really, really hard across the kind of political spectrum in Europe to try to keep those Atlanticist forces alive inside the European Union. I mean, whether he'll succeed, and I don't know. It's very difficult in the face of what Trump is doing.
But do you see the emergence of a new coalition, the willing as it's now been called in the media? Is it something that is real or still too early to tell?
Well, there's a coalition of the willing militarily, but I think there's going to be still a lot of tension between the UK and Europe about trade. I just think, out of self-interest, the UK is interested in trying to strike a separate trade deal with America, and that's going to have to be a bit wider than Starmer would initially want. And that may cause friction and conflict with the European Union. Obviously, the European Union has got some agreement now about trade reprisals for aluminium and steel, but they still have to make decisions about the wider tariffs that have been imposed upon them. And the UK could act as a kind of flag to figures like Maloney, who clearly don't want to go into a full-scale trade war with America. So there may be a point at which the UK's self-interest leads to or helps create some kind of divisions inside the European Union about how it should respond to America. So that is going to be a point of tension ahead.
In terms of EU-UK relations, then, is it feasible, given that we have the first ever EU-UK summit taking place on the 19th of May, to kind of hive off, hermetically seal almost some kind of defence and security pact or agreement without trade economic issues getting in the way? Is that now, given the state of the world as we speak, is so extraordinarily changed since only in a few months that wise heads will say that we should not try and contaminate, should we say, the security discussion going on with other more long-standing trade issues?
Well, it's interesting because the European ambassadors I speak to here in the UK are slightly worried about this summit. They feel they're not getting a lot from the UK about what it wants to put into a security pact. And they think that the UK is deferring, partly because they need to work out how this trade arrangement with America is going to, whether that's going to fly or not. And also that they need to know more about whether Trump can be persuaded to be involved in the Ukrainian reassurance force. So I think there is a, you know, there's there are although there are briefings to the effect that it's going to be possible to put a pact together, I think it might be pretty light in the first instance, or that it will be a statement of intent to go further. And speaking to kind of the French foreign European ministers have been over here talking about we still have a lot of ground to make on the issue of fisheries. So some very old kind of traditional frictions are still there. And I don't think necessarily this, I mean, obviously we'll make every effort to welcome Starmer and not to make it a difficult event. But I think it will be possibly the outcome will be more disappointing than would have been, say, envisaged, say, 3 months ago.
Does that mean then that absent any kind of major breakthrough on security, that the rest, any other conclusions will be seen also as a bit of a damp squib?
Yeah, I mean, I think there'll be, say, I think it's probably going to be an agreement that the UK could have as a third party access to the European Defence Fund, and that would be an important symbol. But I think in terms of a kind of long-term security relationship, I think it will be pretty vague. And actually, the focus anyway now is not on what the UK does in terms of defence in relationship to the European Union as an institution. It's the relationships it can forge through this kind of coalition of the willing, which will not include the whole of the European Union and include countries outside. And that is really where the energy is. I mean, it's quite interesting. Alexander Stubb, who was over presidency in Finland, he was sort of talking very, very warmly about Britain is back and how welcome that was for the rest of the European Union. But he saw it purely in terms of kind of these kind of voluntary arrangements rather than institutional security arrangements between the UK and the European Union, and that is a much more profitable way to view the whole relationship in the future.
Then you mentioned briefly defense funding. You know, there's this, I think, a UK government non-paper circulation suggesting some kind of new mechanism to fund European defense going forward. There's a very similar paper, as you know, put out very recently by the Brussels-based think tank Bruegel on similar lines. Are these initiatives not just essential, some would argue, it doesn't matter whether they overlap at this stage, but also a way of bringing back the UK into the European fold, quote unquote?
Well, as I say, I think it's not going to happen via the European Union, except at the margins. It's the British focus is about really on Ukraine and about what European force can be put together between the French and the British, and which other countries are willing to give kind of backing to that. And I still think I'm afraid to say that the kind of obviously, the discussion inside the UK about relations with the European Union is evolving, and you now get polls not just showing the UK should join the single market. There are polls showing that the UK should rejoin, but I don't think that is a kind of an agenda that Starmer is interested in at the moment. And certainly, I think I'd see it more as a kind of second term possibility rather than anything that he's going to talk about in the near future. There's so much disruption at present. The idea of the UK becoming very closely institutionally linked to the European Union is still anathema to many of the kind of minds that really are influential inside Downing Street, where the focus remains on what's going to happen about the vote of the populists, such as Reform. And that's where, when you talk to them, their minds are the whole time is it's not about a European Union as a kind of a way out of the UK's economic ills.
You mentioned earlier that you are impressed by Starmer's behavior, performance, actions, especially vis-a-vis Ukraine. Do you think that other European leaders and leaders such as Mark Carney recognize that and welcome it? The UK is slowly, I'm not talking about the European Union here, Patrick, but slowly feeling less, almost isolationist. They're sort of coming back into the kind of the broader fold when after Brexit, everybody's wondering what on earth the UK was going to become, a little island all on its own with no anchors anywhere.
You know, I think that has been his skill, and it's really been noticed. One way to view it is that we've been through such a period of instability in the UK, with so many changes of prime minister and so many changes in politics, that Europe obviously just welcomes the very fact that we now have a prime minister in the UK who's likely to be there for 4 to 5 years, and that he has shown an interest in international affairs that wasn't there before, which one wouldn't have known about before. And people often say that being in opposition, about 5% of your time is spent thinking about foreign affairs. And then when you get into government, you know, 50% of your time is spent thinking about foreign affairs. And certainly that's been the case for Keir Starmer. And I think it's always a kind of struggle for any prime minister to balance foreign and domestic, because the domestic audiences often recoil at the idea of their leader being obsessed with foreign affairs. But I think in this case, he's managed to make the linkage with why foreign issues so much matter to the UK. And he's also helped in the sense there's still a consensus inside the UK about the importance of Ukraine. And there's a kind of, which I don't think is, you know, obviously it's not the case in France and Germany, maybe, though they are worried about reform. The electoral system in the UK does hold back the kind of populist parties to a degree, which is not the case in Europe.
As a brief sidebar before we move on, Patrick, what is your take on the appointment a while back now of Jonathan Powell as the National Security Advisor of the UK? What role do you think he's played? What, as you know, he's a quite an understated individual, quite low key person, doesn't seek the limelight, that's for sure. But what kind of influence do you think he wields in UK politics and certainly in Downing Street?
Well, again, it's interesting because you speak to European diplomats and his name comes up time and again. That they say that there's a grip on foreign policy now because of Jonathan Powell. And if anything, now, which is, there's always this kind of tension between Downing Street and the Foreign Office as to who runs things. But it's clear that the sort of centre of influence has shifted from, in terms of foreign affairs, has shifted from the Foreign Office, King Charles Street, to number 10, and that is down to Jonathan Powell, who's obviously a very experienced, knows a lot of these people, understands how the world works. And if you read some of his quite amusing books about Machiavelli, he completely
Yes.
understands how the UK needs to operate vis-a-vis America. He's very Atlanticist and is not the kind of person who thinks that the UK should ever try to blow its trumpet about how it's influenced what America does or doesn't do, but that the American reliance on the kind of reliability of US diplomacy and on the importance of the intelligence relationship is critical. And I think Powell's been really, really important. I mean, obviously you can, his own personal views about the European Union and about the stupidity of Brexit are there, and he's confident. He doesn't shy away from saying internally in meetings what he thinks, and doesn't use circumlocutions. He knows what he thinks, although yet he's quite modest about what he's achieving. He's a very, very impressive civil servant, and sometimes one or two civil servants of that quality make it just a huge, huge difference to how governments operate.
Right. So, how do you see the future of NATO? There's obviously a realization across the European Union now, or European members of NATO to be precise, that they have to increase their spending. Some are already doing it big time, such as Poland. What does the future hold for NATO?
Well, I was in the Munich Security Conference where JD Vance launched this attack on European governing elites. But what had been interesting is just before he made that speech, there'd been a sort of briefings or fears expressed by European leaders that the speech was going to contain announcements about withdrawal of American troops from Europe, and a downgrading of NATO. And that didn't happen. And I think that's still a debate that's going on inside the American administration. I think, on balance, and if you look at what happened in the previous Trump administration, he's going to retain his NATO membership, he's going to retain Article 5, and there's probably going to be a drawdown of American troops in Germany, but that will be the limit of it. And what he's arguing for, if he could argue it in a slightly more or a less abusive way, is quite understood in Europe, which is that defense spending has to rise. Not every country's doing it, but most countries are. And if Trump had any sense, he'd be able to chalk it up when he goes to the NATO summit as a victory to say, look at what my pressure has managed to produce in terms of extra spending by European countries. So I think NATO overall, I think, is a kind of bridge too far for Trump. He's going to remain in that grouping. But that doesn't mean he's going to help Zelensky or help in Ukraine. I mean, it's gone on the back burner for the last few days because of so much else. But there is a kind of pressure being tried to be applied by European leaders on Trump to admit that Vladimir Putin hasn't responded in the way he wanted to in terms of the kind of ceasefire, and that he needs to set a deadline or start to say what kind of sanctions he'll impose upon Russia if they don't agree to that ceasefire. Instead, what we saw notably in those tariff announcements was that Russia was excluded from any kind of extra tariffs based on the excuse that there was no trade between America and Russia. Well, that's not true. So at the moment, it is still the case that all the pressure is being applied on Ukraine and not on Russia to come to the negotiating table. And that is a real problem.
And therefore, to go back briefly to NATO, on the back of this, these huge commitments by European members of NATO on defence. There was talk not so long ago about some new or reinforced European pillar within NATO. Is that no longer relevant or to be being discussed seriously?
Again, I'm sorry to go back about this point, but I just think there is the European Union pillar of NATO is less important than whether there is a cohesive force that is either in or outside the European Union. And I think it's quite possible for there to be a relationship that draws upon NATO's strengths, and which in a sense is going to be, a lot of it is going to be about America. And I don't think there's a need be a conflict there, but I don't think it's about a European Union pillar of NATO at the moment. And the fact that Macron's so engaged with these discussions means that maybe that argument is slightly on the back burner as well.
Right. A final question then, Patrick. Very local to back to Keir Starmer, the British Prime Minister. You said, like as often happens with people who get to Downing Street, that they have to spend much more time than they envisaged on international relations, and it's kind of working. You seem to have grown into the role, as you said earlier. But is there a danger that when it comes to elections, we have local elections in Britain quite soon. Obviously, general election in 4 years' time, if not earlier, that this will not be recognised by the electorate, and there'll be some pushback that the Prime Minister, should be spending more time on domestic issues.
When there was that moment of the where I felt that Starmer sort of grew into the job was when he did start talking about Ukraine in a different way, and there was a kind of temporary push up in the polls for him, but I think that slightly subsided subsequently. And I guess what's driving voters most at the moment is the state of the economy, and nothing that is happening in to the global economy at the moment is going to help Rachel Reeves or see people's incomes rise. So there's a possibility, quite a strong possibility, that these won't be very good local elections for Keir Starmer. But I don't think it's going to turn really on how much the UK public is going to buy the argument that the low growth in the UK and the fiscal situation can be blamed upon Trump, or whether they should be blamed upon sort of economic mismanagement by the British government itself. But I don't think he's going to be good local election results for Starmer, but that doesn't mean that he can't turn this argument around over the years ahead.
Well, thank you. Well, we started by talking about the world. We finished on British local elections in a month's time.
Sorry.
Zoom out and zoom in. But we have to leave it there. Patrick Wintour, thank you very much for your time.
Pleasure.